Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling restless.
Restless? Why?
Because I just really want to find somewhere to sit down and I just can't find somewhere to sit. And in my mind, I have this real vision of something completely spectacularly beautiful, like a really beautiful kind of bench that I can just sit down. I think it's really strong, but it's got a kind of quietness to it. And ideally, it would be carved out of oak and maybe scorched and, and maybe like really taken care of so beautifully that when you sit on it, you just feel like kind of very happy to be in the world. And today's guests, luckily, are here to help.
Woo!
You and I have been big fans of theirs for a long time now. I first saw their work in Shoreditch in 2014 at the gallery that was on the same road as the Carl Friedman Gallery.
They were called Charlotte Road.
Yeah, Charlotte Road, called Marsden Woo, which was an amazing, I think it still is a gallery, but they often show artists who cross over and have that intersection with design and function and form and sculpture. And I used to go there every time they had a show, and I saw an amazing installation there with a number of works by our guests today. And then you became particularly obsessed, and I know that you actually live with a few of their...
Yeah, I've got about five works. Five vessel works.
And the amazing thing about this partnership, the two artists we're going to meet today, is that they're often very functional kind of objects that you can actually interact with, use, you know, sit on, like the benches. But they've actually expanded over the past few decades into major interventions into landscape and even kind of fully formed environments, which you can like go inside and that are still part of a wider landscape, but create their own kind of universe. Mm. And they were also nominees for the 2019 Loewe Craft Prize, which a friend of ours, Jonathan Anderson, has been the kind of brains behind that whole Craft Prize project with Loewe. Yeah, that was really exciting for both of us, wasn't it? We went and saw their...
Yeah.
That's when
I met them.
Is that the first time you met them? Yeah.
Yeah, I was starstruck.
Well, you can continue to be starstruck today, because we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Jim Partridge
and Liz Walmsley. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
We were starstruck as well.
Aww. That's very sweet. Where do we find you in the world right now?
In Shropshire, North Shropshire.
And you're near the Welsh border there, right?
Yeah, just a few miles from the Welsh border. So it's real crossover country, borderlands.
And what's Shropshire like today? What's the weather like?
It's sunny, so cold.
But so sunny, we've got to draw the curtains to stop it blinding us.
So that's lovely. So you live in Shropshire and you also work in Shropshire. Is it in the same building that you do the work? Is that a live-work environment you're in?
Just across the drive.
Just very close.
So 20 yards away.
That's great. And do you have like, is that quite good? I mean, obviously the location, you can get to work easy, but is there some sort of, do you have to set rules in place where this is work and this is home, or does it sort of bleed in?
It all bleeds.
Yeah, it might be a good idea if we had a few more rules, but the commute's very short, but you don't actually leave work in the way that some people can just leave work and leave it behind. But then it's always been a mix.
And it's always a discussion about what's work and what's life anyway.
Right.
You know? Right. So a lot of the things we're making for us. I mean, sometimes if it's commission, it's different, but I'd like to think it remained a hobby, even though it's actually been our job for 40 years.
It's your career. It's one's job.
Yeah, really?
It's like your, yeah. because to quote,
income,
you are
actually, yeah.
So yeah, job and career. But you, to quote, you are internationally regarded as two of the best British artists working in wood.
That's nice to know. That sounds good.
Yeah. So when you just said that you make things for yourself, is that how you, apart from commissions, is that how you predominantly approach your practice? Are you thinking of things that you would want to live in domestically for you, or things that you would want to see in your environment?
There's going to be a lot of pauses in this talk, I think.
That's all right.
I think it would be both those things.
Yeah.
We make things that we think work, and we work on them until they do work the way we want them to work, or they don't get out there really. So, and it's making things that are really functional, but also are quite beautiful and also have looked at, you know, for a seat, say, sort of how you sit, the different ways you sit, the different places you sit. It was interesting, you were talking about the restless bench to start with. Yeah. You know, that's got scoops on it that are a little bit odd. They're not in a straight line or anything, but it's got that air of...
So you can choose whether to sit close to somebody or further away from somebody.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's a slab of wood that's got scoops in it instantly makes somebody recognise it and be comfortable with it as a seat rather than as a, I don't know, a sculptural intervention.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that they're very functional objects, that you use them, changes how people perceive them. So it is all very domestic, I think, what we do. Even the big things feel quite domestic to me.
No, very human.
Human, yeah. It's all human scaled.
I've always really liked them as sculptures as well. I think when I first saw them, I saw them as art in a way. Like, I didn't actually realize you could sit on them, weirdly. To me, they had this kind of they had a kind of majesty. No, but I saw them in Russell's house, and I think seeing them in his context, because he has so much art everywhere that everything kind of becomes like an artwork. And even when he has like a, I don't know, like a dining room table or something, you feel like you don't want to put something on it because it's so beautiful, and it's like a kind of installation, like an environment in itself. But I the thing I personally have really related to with you guys is that my family are Welsh, and my uncle Pat actually makes furniture himself, and he made me a Welsh chair recently. A bit more like, if you think of the kind of tradition of Welsh, you know, furniture, it's one of those amazing, it's almost like what Urkel went on to be inspired by, I think. There's that stick work exactly. But I loved talking with my uncle about the kind of soul of wood and like oak trees and the kind of like movement of grain. And with your work, it's just like, that's why to me they are like sculptures, and they're kind of majestic, is because you see the kind of energy, the flow through the grains of the wood. And even the way you polish it to this kind of lustrous black finish, they're just so gorgeous. You just want to, like, I don't know, like hug them or something.
They're tactile, or sit on them. You want to touch them, and they've got a weight to them, and you have an innate understanding of the potential of the material that you're working with.
And there's a lot of stuff going on with that piece of wood, because there is that texture that you're talking about that makes you want to touch them. But also with something like the block seats, which are made out of a huge chunk of oak that comes from the middle of a tree, you can actually look at how many years you're sitting on. You know, you could be sitting on the last century.
You are pretty,
you know,
much.
There's all sorts of different elements that come into it that you know, as well as what happens visually when you look at it, and the line and stuff like that that we spend ages sort of discussing,
working on.
So you're where you are now, you're surrounded by trees, I take it.
It's quite a lot.
It's quite wooded. And we're not in a forest, but
you're not in a forest. But do you personally like hack down trees, or do you have people that bring wood to you, or, and there's a certain type of wood that you're always kind of drawn to?
We almost always work with oak.
Yeah.
And most of the stuff we do needs quite big diameter trees, sort of. So we start with a log, really, rather than planks.
The butt of a tree.
Shropshire, there's a lot of old parkland and those sort of, if you imagine oak trees growing in parkland conditions, big spready oaks, that kind of thing. They grow big diameters rather than tall.
And thin.
And so there's quite a lot of it around. But to directly answer your question, mostly we get timber from one or two sawmills nearby, and they mostly get it from the area. And it's not commercially grown oak, it's trees that have come down because there's a road development or a house being built, or for some reason they've blown down or whatever.
So sustainability-wise, it's trees that are sort of have been felled for a reason,
other than straight forestry.
Yeah. I mean, we had one job building a very long bridge in Jersey, and for that actually we ended up using French oak, because the French were growing their oaks in woodlands and quite close together, so it produces something taller and straighter and thinner, but still, you know, still strong in the same ways. Yeah. So we ended up using those kind of things because we needed the length. We didn't need width, you know. For the most part,
And one of the other things we use quite a lot of, if we can get it, is curved logs. So if you imagine either a very big branch off an even bigger tree that's sort of curving up, round and up, or a tree that's grown on a hillside and sort of curved up towards the sun. Because if we then cut a shape out of that curved log, the grain is going around the curve rather than across it. So we can kind of exploit that. So as it dries out and cracks, we can make those cracks follow the line of the object we're making. So even though we're generating the shape, we can kind of exploit what's already in the tree, or was already in the tree.
You're sort of working with it.
So yeah, working with it. Because I suppose that's one of the things we haven't said that's significant about a lot of what we make is it's made out of unseasoned wood. So we do a lot of the shaping first and then let it shrink and dry out and crack up.
What is unseasoned then? What is
seasoned? Unseasoned as it's growing. So it's still full of sap.
So freshly chopped or fairly freshly chopped.
Freshly felled, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because oak dries out very slowly anyway, because it's drying out from the outside in. So
as it dries out, it shrinks and warps and cracks open a bit.
And the drying out process is to get rid of the sap once you've kind of hacked it off of a section, then the sap will drain off, or will it evaporate?
It evaporates out slowly over months or a couple of years, possibly.
Years.
Does it?
I was just thinking, I was trying to explain how much water or sap there is in a log. So I think we sometimes weigh them to see whether they finish drying out. And so something that perhaps starts at, say, 140 kilos, so a chunk of wood that is like the weight of two people, if they're 70 kilos each, would probably lose 40 kilos of water as it dried out. So it'd probably end up at 100 kilos.
And it shrinks. In that process, it shrinks, and it shrinks a lot. Yeah. It shrinks more than people think. Because a lot of stuff that people buy, when they buy kiln-dried timber, has been cut into thin planks, and it's been dried in a sort of...
Quite quickly.
Yeah, quite quickly. And the bowls are sometimes dried quite quickly, the vessels.
If
you've got vessels there, you should see a kind of...
But we don't mind if they crack.
Kind of irregularity.
That celebration of that.
As they dry. Yeah.
So I guess for you guys, timing feels like it's a big factor of your practice. Timing for waiting for trees to come to you. I mean, you've got to obviously put orders in, but then the timing for once you've got them, of cutting them up and then waiting for them to dry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of waiting around, is there, or?
There is.
Which is why
a lot of the work happens first. So we've got a house full of things that are drying out, but we can still sort of enjoy them as objects.
We kind of regularly go to the sawmills, particularly one sawmill, and look at what they've got in. And then if there's something that would suit what we want to make, we kind of, we put our name on it and we eventually get that piece of timber, and then we will work with that and make something. Oh. So you make the initial shape, well, the vast majority of the shaping, and then you dry it out for quite a long period. So, and you watch as it dries, and we weigh it to see how much water it's losing. And some of those big pieces never dry out completely, because you'd have to keep them for about, I don't know how many years you'd have to keep them, but. So sometimes things do kind of carry on opening up a little bit afterwards, but you know, providing they haven't gone the other side of the world, we can maintain that if we need to.
Yeah, and this sawmill you go to, is it quite competitive then? You know, you say you put your name on it, people turn up and they're like, Jim and Liz have got this, and like, for God's sake, they've got that again. How comes they get everything? Is there any sort of like local competition with people that are making furniture? And
not really, no. It's more to do with the fact that they have their own very unique way of organizing their business.
Yeah.
They're dealing with all sorts of all sorts of wood, and they do planks, they do firewood with all the spare bits. They sell stuff to us in sort of butt form, you know, the trunks. They very often don't answer their phone, so you have to go there.
Right.
So it's yeah.
Sounds like they haven't got a website then showing you all the logs that are in.
No, they haven't got email.
They haven't got email?
Well, or if they have, they don't use it.
Right. You've got to be there in person, old school.
All this time that you have, it kind of lends itself for you guys to like think up ideas as well, I guess. It must create a kind of space. It becomes like this big kind of, I don't know, like...
There's things... at different stages going on all the time. So we've got things that are nearly ready to be delivered, and we've got logs that are waiting to be cut up, and they all have different kinds of thinking associated with them. And then what we probably are short of and would like to get more of is time to just think abstractly of what would be good to try next. But that's often triggered by finding a piece of wood that's a certain shape, or somebody saying, can we have a table or whatever.
Yeah, it's a whole mixture of
things. It's how you start off on a project. It's different from how you finish it.
Yeah. So if it isn't a commission, you're guided by the wood that you've got in your possession?
Yeah, largely. Yeah.
And you seem to work very minimally. It feels like there's a very contemporary feel, even though it's it's wood, which is, you know, historical as a material. But you work very minimally. There's such a minimalism and the clean lines to what you're working with.
Yeah.
Where does that aesthetic come from? Something like art history, or does that come from design or architecture?
We've always liked modernism and minimalism.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose that if you want to kind of ask where that does come from. Yeah.
I think
architecture, but liking the simple lines and
uncluttered
design.
Yeah. But I think one of the first project we worked on together was at Grisdale Forest up in the Lake District, where they had a big sculpture project that had been going on for maybe 3 or 4 years when we got there, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we were the first people there to go and work on the sort of infrastructure on footbridges and stiles and gates and public seating and things like that, but using the same criteria that the sculptors there were working with. And that's where we saw a big range of public art, I suppose, or art particularly in a rural landscape at that point.
Mm.
And so people like David Nash and Andy Goldsworthy and
land artists,
Richard Harris. Mm. I mean, they'd all been working there either at the same time we were or just before.
Mm.
So we were very taken with that whole school of land art,
and also it fitting into its environment, which is another aspect that we haven't really talked about that much. But it was for site specific. Things.
Yeah,
but in terms of the simple lines, which is what you were talking about, I think it's what we like, And it's what we like in terms of design, what we've liked in terms of architecture through, you know, the 20th century, I suppose. So it's, and not wanting fussiness, not wanting decoration, not wanting those things that, you know, are parts of very successful other practices, but it's not what we like.
And there's enough going on in the wood anyway that you don't need to
embellish it.
Yeah, to embellish it. You don't need to carve acorns on something to make it look like an oak.
Yeah,
and it has a strength, I think, in that simplicity. Yeah. Not always that easy to achieve simplicity.
I actually think there's something really powerful about, if you think of works that you've made that are kind of almost like traditional benches that you might have. I don't know, like you did one in Wisley at the RHS Wisley, which is a kind of curved seat. And then you did the amazing one at CB1 Cambridge, where you've got, you were talking earlier about the curve in the wood, but like that's a great example of that kind of shape and movement of the
and
curve.
It's like a biker rack as well at the back.
Brilliant. Yeah. But I love it when you have those kind of curved shapes within like a landscape.
And those two pieces you mentioned were both constructed rather than carved out of solids, so we're actually generating the curve quite consciously. So that's not the case of finding a curvy log and saying, oh, this would be nice. That's a case of us saying we want something that spirals around this space.
Because it worked in the space. Yeah. And actually that piece, the one at CB1, I mean, it has a bike rack because everybody's got a bike in Cambridge, and it's right by the station where lots of people cycle to. Mm. And it also was a celebration of a business there that had started bringing in bulks of timber along the railway, and then from over 100 years before. And then they had, over that century, kind of refined to being a very sort of sophisticated DIY sort of or builder's centre.
Yeah.
And so that piece of work goes from fat chunks, fat short chunks at one end, around this curve, all the pieces getting finer and thinner and taller more as delicate. They get to the other end. So it was to celebrate a century of that business's existence.
Oh, wow.
So that gave us a sort of key into the project. I don't think many people looking at it would be
aware
of that. Yeah, and then that doesn't matter at all. But they would be aware that it's curving and tapering and changing from one end to the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is it like making work as a married couple? You've got a long established collaboration. You've had like 30 years. I think in 1986 you started designing and making furniture together. Over 30 years of like two minds coming together making work. What is that like, living and working and, you know, trying to get, this is my idea, I think this is a better design for the curve, or I want this, or what is that been like?
Sometimes we completely agree and that goes swimmingly. And if we both like something, there's a good chance that other people will like it as well.
Okay, that's a barometer.
Other times, one or other of us is pushing for something and the other one either goes along or doesn't. And
what happens if the other one doesn't go along?
Somebody's right.
It's nothing. I don't think anything goes out there that either one of us wouldn't want to go out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's a discussion and the other person is either persuaded or in the process of that discussion, the idea is developed in a different way.
Yeah.
So
hopefully the discussion happens earlier on in the project. So you haven't, if it's a non-starter, hopefully you haven't done too much work.
Mm. Yeah. And it is.
Then wasted it because it's not working for one of us.
And it is a bit more, you know, two heads are better than one sort of case, really, because you've got two lots of people firing in ideas about something, or one bit of an idea, then somebody picks up that idea and thinks, I mean, if we did that, what about this? Mm. So, you know, there's...
What if?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of what ifs and how about and can you come and look at this?
Yeah.
Kind of conversation.
What's it like if you do sort of have something that doesn't work or fails? Because often we talk about the successes of people's careers and you talk about their monumental achievements, but often the failures are quite interesting. So like, I just watched a documentary about Bridget Riley and I was thinking about you guys quite a lot in that. I watched it last night and her relationship to nature. I think she would love your benches, you know, because she could then look out, you know, to nature. Like, I've got two questions. One is about, like, do you see things as a mistake, or do they then lead you somewhere else? And then also, does the nature, like, do you directly respond to nature and the shapes of nature when you're thinking of the shapes that you're going to create?
To answer the second one, I don't think we directly respond. We saw that program about Bridget Riley. It's really good.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Love that kiss picture. Anyway. Yeah. No, I think if a piece is going into a specific environment, then you think about that.
Right.
So to that sense, if it's a piece outside, it's the nature of the environment around it.
Yeah.
But
I think we're doing a bit less of that kind of work at the moment. So we're doing more speculative pieces, really, aren't we? Unless that are
that's the plan
for this exact spot.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've forgotten what the first question was.
No, about like, do you see them as failures, or do you see them as a
means? It's pretty rare that the things are complete failure that you can't learn something from. Just occasionally we say, never going to do that again.
What has that been? Like, what would you do again?
Well, one thing which wasn't a failure at all, was real success, we thought, was we curated an exhibition, and we're not curators.
It
was called Sitting and Looking, and we made loads of furniture for people to sit on and look at other people's work. And then we invited 7 or 8 other people to fill the exhibition space.
Yeah.
So we had jewellers, ceramicists, and so we had... We had different people who were actually in the exhibition, and we provided the furniture to put their exhibits on and also to sit and look at it. And the idea was that lots of exhibitions, you just walk past stuff and you don't really see it properly.
Yeah.
So we made spaces where there was seating so that people could discuss things with one another, with the objects in front of them. Yeah. So we did that, and that we thought that was very successful.
Yeah, it was really successful as an exhibition, but as curators, we never wanted to do that again.
So there's one thing.
Oh, really?
So many emails, so much.
Yeah,
did briefly think it made us better people, because we said, oh, we're always going to reply to emails straight away from now on.
And we're going to respect curators hugely. But there's, in terms of work, we've got a wood burning stove, and some pieces have ended up in that.
So it's fuel.
But not very many, really.
Do you worry about the public commissions, about how they're going to survive and how the use and stuff? Because there was a work I found out about which was called Log Lookout, which was made in 96, 97, but in 2004 had to be dismantled because it just broke down over time. Are things like that quite painful, or are you quite, like, released and that's just the nature of the beast we're working with?
That particular one was made out of softwood logs.
Right.
There's a few things I've had to come down after, but it's after 20 years or 25 years or something. I don't know. That's a pretty good lifespan for a bit of outdoor public furniture that hasn't had any maintenance.
No, and that was the one at Kielder, wasn't it?
That was the one at Kielder,
Kielder Forest, that was.
I mean, it's a shame that it's not there, but...
Would you want to replace it, sort of thing, or are you like, that work and that's its lifespan? And
it's really hard work, that one. I wouldn't want to rebuild another the same.
Right.
And it was...
We're older now.
It was a glorious idea, but having to chip the ice off before you could put the next layer on was was not so good.
And it was just you two installing it? Wow. And it took a year to install.
No.
Most of a winter, I think.
Gosh. I mean, silly time to be doing it.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's almost like the idea, like, it doesn't have to last forever. It's almost like it's enough for it to have a lifespan. And that's quite poetic in itself, isn't it? Yeah. And I guess if you think of nature, which your work is so linked to, kind of does make sense in the cycle.
It was a fantastic piece at Grisdale when we were there that David Nash made, called Wooden Waterfall. And it was just this, it started with this just sort of fallen log and that was by a stream, and he cut a groove in it and the water ran down it. And then he put another bit of fallen timber underneath it, cut a groove in that, and the water ran down that. And it was a very, I think he intended it as a very ephemeral piece, but people loved it so much they kept repairing it and scraping the leaves out of the gullies and putting a new little bit,
making
it
sure
sort of, it was like the opposite of vandalism. People just were drawn to want to make it work and get water.
It's vandalism, not vandalism, but yeah, vandalism, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Well, whereas with the log lookout, I mean, I think the there's always insurance implications for any place that's got the public going into it, and if they have a worry that some child is going to climb up it and fall off or whatever, or put their foot through something, then I think it comes down. And it had its time. And I'm sure that it's a great site for other pieces of work that other people might do. You know, it was on the junction of a road where there had been lots of battles, because it's Northumberland and, you know, with the Scottish border, lots of skirmishes and things. And we kind of built it with the sort of shape that fitted with the landscape that you could see from it, the hills that were there. So it was very particular to that place, and it had its moment. And I think, I'm sure there are lots of other creative people who can come along and do something on that site.
Site specific, And when it comes to like process and what your trademark is this scorching or the bleaching that when you come to recognise your furniture, you can absolutely see that it's Jim and Lizzie's work? And especially when it comes to the vessels, because Jim, the vessels is solely your department. But how did you come to discover the scorching that would be kind of the thing that you would really throw yourselves into?
Well, I've been doing quite a lot of wood turning anyway, making vessels. And then I was artist in residence at Cruinell Sager College, it was called then. I think it's part of Manchester Metropolitan now. And they had a wood, metal, ceramics, textiles course. So I was there and hanging around. And I'd been doing some wood turning, and one of the guys there, one of the students, and I was only 2 or 3 years older than most of them anyway, one of the students said, "Oh, you ought to burn that." And I think it was a sort of...
In the sense that it's rubbish.
Yeah, it was a joke.
Okay.
Well, I think also what you're not saying is that the work you'd done previously had been very fine holly bowls.
Yeah.
So very delicate. Fine, delicate holly bowls.
Hollywood.
You've done a few of more recently, but but then you went from that to quite thick, chunky oak.
Well,
which was quite a big change. And lots of people weren't too sure about that.
So I did try burning it to sort of call his bluff and sort of put two fingers back up to him. And it looked quite good, nice sort of shiny black. But then I tried it with, and that was holly or fruit wood of some sort. But then I tried it with elm initially, and then oak. And they're quite coarse grained timbers. There's a very big difference between the growth that happens in the summer when it's growing quickly and the winter when it's hardly growing at all. And when you burn that, the summer growth, this quick growth, gets burnt away more quickly.
Okay.
So I'm burning it with a blowtorch.
Yes.
So that when you scrub the soot off to get the kind of dirt off it, it actually changes the texture quite dramatically in it. Even though it's sort of less brown and less wooden in one sense, it actually makes it much more, it makes the grain much more apparent. So I really loved that from straight away, and kind of we've just carried on doing it.
That was, when was that?
I was 19, early 1980s, I think.
I think I've got one of yours here from 1986. Like I've got that I found at an auction. If you're recognizing,
it's got like a red tip. 86. So 86 is when we started the outdoor stuff.
Oh, cool.
So I'd been doing bowls
before that. Ooh. Let's have a look.
That's a nice
one. Yeah.
This one here, and it has like a red kind of mouth around the top.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I remember that.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So this is from the 80s, isn't it?
Probably took quite a long time to make.
And it's
how long does it take to make something like that? To like
a vessel
turn
like that?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I usually cop out that by saying, well, about 40 years.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Practicing.
But,
well, the actual time on the lathe, assuming it comes out in one go and you don't have to rework it for some reason, it's probably on the lathe for a couple of hours.
Yeah. Wow. And how do you stop this, like the soot forming then? Because if you are scorching, there must be lots. Because touching these now, there's the finish is quite.
Well, you just got to scrub it hard to get all the loose off, and it just leaves a bit of charcoal.
It's burnt.
Charred surface.
But, it's burnt quite hard, yeah. So it's quite a lot of soot.
Yeah.
Horrible job.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
And how did you two then meet then? Because if you were, that was the initial sort of vessels that you were making alone. And then how did you two meet and I guess fall in love and then realise that you were kind of like-minded creative souls?
Because you worked in ceramics, didn't you, Liz? That's your background.
Way before, quite a while before that. And actually one of the exciting things when I met Jim and went round to his house first was that he had lots of vessels there that he'd made, or was in the process of making. And I found that really exciting because it was at that time I hadn't worked in a pottery for maybe 6 years or something like that. And so, but it was just, and And I think Jim's shapes at that time were quite ceramic in a way, it felt quite ceramic to me.
Well, like moon jars, aren't they?
That's yeah. What yeah. I was really excited by them. So I think it
not
was...
me. Did you get that?
Oh, right. So she fell in love with the wood for the vessels rather than Jim.
It's very, very, yeah, very hard to separate them. I'd say.
Do you still work in ceramics now? Do you, aside from doing the furniture together? No. So it's solely you guys are on.
No, that was something I did. I did when I was a student in between holidays. I did it after I finished my degree, and for about 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. 6 years working in a pottery, and that was a long time ago. And then I stopped doing that, and I worked in a shop and I did music. But I'd always been interested in clay, and when I was a child, one of my dad's friends gave me this big slab of clay, which later I recognized as the kind of blocks of clay you get from Wenger's and places like that in Stoke-on-Trent, or did at that time. And I just made stuff with it, always made stuff.
What's Wenger's in Stoke-on-Trent? Is that like a
factory? I don't know if it still exists. It was just a supplier for pottery equipment glazes and clay. And I think it was called Wenger's. It's a long time ago now.
But we've both always been people who've made things. Mm. You know, well, if not professionally, we've always done it anyway and always did do it.
How are you finding now this kind of celebration in craft? Because I guess when it comes to fine art, you've been on the craft side of it when it comes to furniture making and working with wood. Do you feel there's been a massive shift now in seeing craft as it should be alongside contemporary art?
I think
Has it shifted?
Yeah. It's taken more seriously now.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're just on a base level of looking at auction prices of things. It's,
Liz is thinking.
Yeah. It's too big a question.
Well, because you're in so many collections. You're like in the V&A, the Craft Council, Manchester Art Gallery, the Kyoto Museum of Modern Art. You've been nominated for... prizes. Yeah. There's all these prizes now, like what Jonathan set up with the Wave Craft Prize and the Jerwood Furniture Prize. Yeah. There's a big celebration for that. And but there always still seems to be this hierarchy that that's art and that's craft. But now there is, I feel like in the last few years, there's been a kind of breakdown of
it's
that hierarchy.
Loosened up a bit, I think.
Yeah. Have you noticed, have you felt that shift at all?
It hasn't really changed what we do. It maybe changes how people perceive what we do, or who changes perhaps where it gets shown a little bit.
Right.
There are more galleries that are, you know, like Marsden Wu, that you'd be hard pressed to say.
To define it.
Yeah.
No, I think it has changed. I think you're right. It has changed.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. And I think possibly that's because I'm a big fan of three-dimensional objects that have that complexity of a function and a form and sometimes a message. So it's...
I was just thinking, if you think back a bit further, like when you were working in the pottery and when I was first doing woodwork, you know, domestic pottery was everywhere. There were hundreds of domestic potters making stuff, and people were buying, you know, mugs and stuff. And I think there is less of that now, isn't there? So the art ceramics might have gone up. I think domestic ceramics.
Well, ceramics are definitely being seen in a different, in a more contemporary art context now. Yeah. Just with artists like Grayson Perry, for example, they kind of change that narrative.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
He had that great quote, didn't he, about it being more embarrassing. Easier to come out as a transvestite than as a potter.
Yeah, exactly.
To his art friends.
I mean, the good thing about this kind of perceived shift is that I think more people are getting to actually look at craft, as you know, and actually interact with it more. And for example, there's an exhibition which has just opened in the Oxford Ceramics Gallery, which you guys are a central part of, called On the Table. And this is running till the 22nd of December and will be a great opportunity to actually visit if you live in the UK and see some of your work. Can you talk a bit about that new centrepiece which you guys have created, which is the kind of...
And you've gone back to Hollywood as well for that.
Yeah. Russell loves Hollywood.
Yes. I need some Hollywood in my life, yes.
Can be arranged.
Yeah, the exhibition is called On the Table. And we've
made the table.
The table.
But you didn't curate this one.
No.
Okay, right.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's got a wide variety of amazing work in there.
Some lovely ceramics and metalwork, but all, it's not all domestic ware in the sense that you'd be drinking your tea out of it, but it's all domestic scaled ceramics and silverware. And
yeah, there's a separate project of some, I think, six silversmiths that Amanda Game organised. So there's
six pairs of cup silver little vessels, drinking cups.
Yeah. It's real quite a range of work on that table. And I think they've got some on the walls, but they are moving the exhibits around and putting, so sometimes they'll be on the table and sometimes they'll be somewhere else.
I think the intention was sort of to remind people of the, in a way, to get things down from the shelves and to handle them, use them, not just
display.
To look at them.
Yeah, decorative.
I'm really interested in the link between Japan as well, because there's works by the Japanese master Shoji Hamada, and then you've also got Dame Lucy Rye and Edmund Duval, and even a friend of ours, Giles Round, who I have ceramics right behind me here on my
Oh, let's have a look.
Yeah, but I love Giles's ceramics, and he's someone that's definitely bridged the contemporary art.
Yes.
You know,
The work in the exhibition is quite different to that piece, isn't it?
Yeah,
that one's like almost like an urn where he kind of like burnt ashes inside it and stuff.
Yeah.
It was almost like part of a performance, I think.
Yeah.
But what I like is the combination of these different influences, because often you think to Japan, even with like, you know, ceramics, obviously, but also China and different countries and like the kind of influences. What were your kind of early influences? Was it more European, or were you looking to places like Japan?
I think more European.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like Bauhaus-y or...
Eileen Gray comes straight to mind for me.
Oh, right,
as a furniture maker.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I think the furniture maker of the 20th century, probably.
So that's
the
Art Deco period.
Mm. Oh, you're pushing me there. I can't quite remember what her dates are.
It's like 19.
She started out as a lacquerist, doing sort of quite traditional lacquered ware, and then ended up being designing buildings and architecture in a very modernist, minimalist style.
Mm.
And then the furniture kind of went from one to the other.
Yeah.
Her Brancusi is a sculptor, I suppose.
Anybody contemporary you're looking at now?
You mean as influences?
Yeah. Or do you collect? Do you collect furniture of other artists, or do you make your own everything? Like,
we mostly make our own.
We haven't got a room.
Collect furniture, no.
No, the occasional little bit.
Magistretti furniture we have.
Oh, yeah.
Mid-century.
Nice. Yeah. Yes. Vito Magistretti.
Yes.
Vico.
Yeah.
Vico.
Vico, that's it, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. The Maralunga.
Sofa. Great sofa.
Yes, and we have some dining chairs, you know, plastic dining chairs.
Love those.
They are plastic.
Yeah, dining chairs that are, you know, his design's just lovely and so clever, you know.
But a Ron Arad chair.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
But that was a swap for something.
an art trade.
Yeah.
There's, who else in terms of influences? We have
buy ceramics.
We have a collection of small ceramics. So like there's some people have got really big versions. We've got really little versions of things.
Of artists working today or historical?
Yeah. Because our house isn't particularly huge, it's hard to have space to put all this stuff and still have a bit of a minimal feel to it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the struggle, isn't it? You're talking about Eileen Gray earlier, but some of the things you've done, which I really love the look of, were you made a library at one point, and there's kind of like these interior, even like cafes and different interior spaces. Oh, is that something you enjoy, like creating these kind of environments?
Yeah,
it's a different challenge. And it's just kind of, what's it going to be used for, and how is it going to be used, and
does it want?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I think Liz is a natural interior designer, really.
I'm curating the house all the time.
Oh, really?
Oh, so you'll curate your own house, but nobody else's.
Yeah. My sister.
I'm the same as you, Liz. I'm always shifting things around, moving art, putting different chairs and stuff in.
Yeah, if you can't change your life, change your furniture.
That's a good quote.
As in moving around. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I have a lot of other heroes, which I see you kind of in the lineage of, which is like Alexandre Knoll. Do you know his work? And like the J.B. Blunk house is like on my wish list. Do you know J.B. Blunk?
No.
I'm
going to write that one down.
J.B. Blunk, and it's up in like the Redwoods area, I think, of like San Francisco, sort of. I got that wrong, but up there is America, and he carved a whole house out of wood, and everything inside it is like living, and he's passed on now, and now there's like an estate that looks after it. But that's
sounds a bit too woody for my taste.
Too woody, yeah. Bit Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs sort of territory. But I think it needs to be seen. Yeah. And Alexandre Knoll was a French carver, was French artist.
Yeah.
Who I think is just phenomenal. But I see your work for me in that same kind of lineage.
Well, that's very flattering. Thank you.
No worries.
Do you guys like the idea of the viewer or the audience somehow activating what you create, so that almost like it becomes complete when it starts to be experienced, you know, people actually sitting on it, contemplating the world around them? Is there an element of like enjoying, sort of encouraging slowing down or taking in the environment around you?
Yeah, to a degree. That's partly what sitting and looking exhibition was about. That was to try and get people just to sit and look at something and not to walk past it onto the next amazing bit of something and then onto the next one. So there is that. We've always asked that, if at all possible, you know, the work that we have in exhibitions can be sat on, and very often at a private view I'll sit on it, so that people get the idea that this is a good plan, because people will often look at things and think, but can I sit on it?
Yeah.
You know, want people to feel how it feels to sit on
it. And that function and use, functionality, I mean, it does change how you perceive an object. If you're using it, if it's a vessel that's got fruit in it, I made a bowl for someone recently who wanted it for their kitchen to have salt in. And if you picture those black bowls, but with a little scoop in it, with filled with salt. I mean, it's a fantastic idea. Mm. It wasn't my idea, it was her idea. Mm. So I was really pleased to do that.
Good. So listeners, if you want commissions, if you've got ideas, then go to Jim and Liz.
Those are really good ideas.
Yeah. What? How does that work within commissions, like in public commissions and people giving you commissions? Is there a kind of back and forth of ideas, or do you sort of, if it's, you know, a really strong public commission, they've got an idea, you have to kind of go with what they want?
Once we've done in the past, there's usually been quite a clear brief. I mean, we haven't done a commission like that for 4 or 5 years.
Big public at Arley Gallery.
Welbeck Abbey. It was about
four or five years ago.
Well, and that was a brief to make furnish for outside the new building and in the entrance to the new building, and to kind of lift
and through into the gallery
and through into the gallery spaces. So we know what the building is going to look like. It's a new building in an old site, so there's new stuff and old stuff, and we're trying to make something that connects the two.
So we would normally make, we would listen to what their brief is, and then we would make a model. Yeah. And then they decide if they like the model. And actually, generally, people do. I can't think of situations where they've said, oh, no, I don't like that.
Yeah.
But in terms of, yeah, that's sort of public commissions.
Yeah, so model making is quite features in the public commissions.
Mm. Yeah.
As a way of working out and making sure that everybody is agreed that this is the way forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas if we're just making something to go in a gallery, it doesn't really matter as long as it fits through the door in the gallery. There's no
rules.
No rules. You know, it sells or it doesn't sell. But yeah.
And what about sort of more ambitious projects in the sense of like bridges? Because you've made a number of bridges, which I absolutely love. One of my favourites is actually the smallest one, which is in Morven, Scotland. Which it's called Ardtornish.
Yeah.
I love that
bridge with three steps on it.
It's amazing.
And one handrail.
I'm going to post a picture of it on our Instagram. But I love the different bridges you've made. Can you speak a bit about the challenges that presents when you make a more ambitious kind of larger work? That I guess so, you must have to work with structural engineers or something.
With bridges up to a certain size, it's dead straightforward.
Yeah.
And we have got a graph that an architect friend of ours produced saying, if you're using slabs of wood to make a bridge, if it's 2 meters long, it needs to be 200 millimeters deep. Oak. If it's 4 meters long, it needs to be.
Yeah,
and so that's sort of very straightforward.
I've got that. Wow. Doesn't sound straightforward. It sounds terrifying to me. But I love your confidence.
over a certain length, you do need to get an engineer involved.
Right, and also, right. It depends who you're working for. If you're working for a council who want a bridge in a certain place, they will want to have all of that stuff absolutely tied down.
And that's not all.
Fair enough.
That's not all engineering. That's also a lot to do with
public
liability and safety. So handrail heights, there's rules about that. You've got to obey them.
Access.
The gaps between verticals. If it's attached to a house and it's part of house building regulations, then it's the same rules as apply to banisters on your staircase. Can't have gaps bigger than 100 millimeters because babies can get their head stuck through them. If it's outdoors and not attached to a building, the rules are slightly different, but obviously there are obvious practical, serious things like you don't want people to fall off and you don't want pram wheels to go over the edge. But I mean, we have done things in private spaces where, you know, we did one bridge that was maybe 5 meters long, just a single curved slab chunk of fallen tree. And we made two handrails, but the customer said, we put one on, and the client said, that looks great.
I want it like that.
Let's keep it like that. So it just has one handrail, you know, which you couldn't do in a public space.
Which we preferred, but, you know, we were thinking that you would need to have more than one. But I've come the stuff we make tends to be a little bit over, you know, the beams are very often thicker than they need to be or whatever, because it is, you know, that big, strong pieces of timber are very attractive to us.
Mm.
And is there a kind of like romantic or poetic kind of idea behind the idea of a bridge? Because for me, there is. Like, I see it not necessarily to do with fairy tales, but more to do with bringing people together and
that
bridging of space. And
they start off straight away with the positive.
Yeah.
It's a connecting and an interconnecting.
Bridging is.
And we quite often made things that curving and tapering as well. So there's this sense of a journey just in the crossing of the bridge.
Yeah, I mean, there are lovely things that you can get into.
They're really nice to make.
That whole little book about the bridge. Mm. We'll send you a copy. It's just a playful thing that booklet that Jim did about the bridge. But, you know, when you think about stuff like that, you think about rims, they're connecting points. You know, think about rims on a vessel.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they're inside, outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But bridges. Good things, bridges.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Love a bridge. Love a bridge. Well, before we get to our final questions, I just want to highlight a work which I want to go and see, which is an altar that you designed for Christ Church Cathedral in 2000 in Oxford, which, and you've been nominated for many, many prizes, but I know that you won this prize, which is the ACE Award, which I didn't know existed, for art in a religious context in 2003 for this work. But can we just talk a little bit about that? Because images look amazing. I mean, Oxford itself is, and Christ Church, the history there and everything, but this is a permanent altar that is there.
Yeah.
How was that?
That
was quite stressful.
Yeah, quite amazing.
Because of the history attached.
Yeah. And because we decided to make a table, basically. And I think, what was it that the D said? He said,
well, what is an altar? What's it for? And he John Drury, wasn't it, gave us sort of clear instructions with the history of altars in the Catholic tradition and in the Church of England tradition and the differences and all this and that. But he ended up saying, well, basically it's a workmate for a vicar. So it's got to be at that sort of height and you've got to be able to put things on it and stand behind it.
Yeah, so we got, we then designed something which was a table that was solid that we cut a cross out of. So it's almost like the church and the congregation and this sort of,
so should we try and describe it? She throws her hands up.
He's like, absolutely not. We are not describing anything today. Jim, I said this from the start.
Solid cube, an enormous solid cube of wood.
Yes.
So big that we couldn't find anything around here. And it ended up with getting something from...
Came from Windsor Park, Windsor Great Park. The log. And then we made a kind of rectangle out of it. And then out of what is now the underneath, we cut out a
three of that rectangle.
Of that rectangle, we cut out a cross shape that comes up in curve. I can't describe it either.
We'll put images on.
So when you remove the cross, you're left with basically an asymmetric four-legged table and a cross and an obvious link between the two.
But there's like a window, isn't it? The cross forms a window.
Yeah.
So yes. And the shape that's left after the cross came out was like very much like a church window with the curve to a point at the top.
So there's lots of room for metaphor and interpretation if you want to.
There was a wonderful moment when I was working underneath on the underneath of it. So I was lying on the floor, working on the underneath of this altar. And the choir was rehearsing in the room next door, and it was dusk, and the light was really sort of mellow, and I just thought, this is bliss. It was just beautiful sounds in a fantastic sort of setting.
But I think the that was when we were installing it, wasn't it? I think the hardest part of that job actually wasn't for us, it was for John Nielsen, who's the letter cutter, who cut the bit of text that goes with it, because the altar's to celebrate George Bell, Bishop Bell. So John cut this sort of 20 words of text straight into the cathedral floor. He said he'd probably been down on his knees in front of the altar for more than anyone in the last several centuries. And there's no going back.
Chipping away at a 500-year-old floor.
Wow.
You've got to be so confident in your spelling.
So he had a tricky job.
Can you imagine? You've got your E and your I back to front on something. Oh my God. We're going to post images of that, because that to me looks really magical and I'd love to go and see that.
Yeah.
So we go on to our last questions, which are, the first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could steal any work of art in the world, whatever it is, another piece of furniture, a building, ceramic, what would it be and why?
One each or one between us?
Oh, yeah, let's do one each. It's so much fun.
You can have two. Yeah.
I think I would have a Lucy Rhee vessel.
Ooh, oh, you would, yeah. Mm. So you must have seen a lot of them in the flesh over the years.
One of those beautiful footed bowls, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm really torn for myself. I was thinking about this question because I knew you asked this question.
Yeah.
And I started off thinking, I'll definitely have an Eileen Gray screen. there's a lacquered black one, which I think the V&A have got one. And then I thought, then I saw that program about Bridget Riley and I thought, oh, I really love that picture of hers that was called The Kiss. So I'd have that.
It's amazing, that work.
It was just two black shapes, not quite kissing.
Because we tried to think of things that we agreed on.
Yeah, so we would both have that.
Yeah. What's your work in the V&A?
Bridget Riley.
Yeah. What's the work that you have in the V&A collection?
They've got one of our block seats.
An early block seat, yes. With a very burry piece of oak.
That's in their furniture collection. They've also got we made the plinth for a piece of glass.
By Colin Reed,
that's in a different gallery.
I think that's in the religious gallery. Yeah,
can't remember.
Sacred
gallery.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what it's called.
Right. Yeah. Now, them single block seats, there's several examples of them. Yeah. And they're something that you go back to a lot.
Yeah.
They're
still fun to make. I mean, we've made.
Yeah, and you're responding to the timber as well, and they are all different.
Yeah. Just started on a pair of them at the moment. Yeah. So two from this cut from the same block of wood. So the cut surface is the end grains will match up. So I'm imagining them on either side of the fireplace or something.
Yeah.
When you use that word, Liz, just then, burry. So that means kind of being covered with
knots
and barbs and quills.
Sort of little ingrowing.
Yeah, it's a sort of ingrowing imperfection that interrupts the whole sort of flow of the timber.
Yeah.
Mm. You see it on the outside of oak trees, great big sort of
gnarly lumps.
Yeah.
That's a burr, and it goes into the trunk as well in a kind of pointed way.
So they're an outside influence on the tree. They're not part of
it. Yeah, I think it's a fungal thing that causes it.
Oh, right.
And then when we cut off the bark and we cut off the sap, so quite a bit of that would go, but there's very often a lot that goes further into the tree.
I think that bowl that you had in your hand earlier.
Yes. Yes.
Has that got, that's the imperfections in that are sort of.
Yeah, it's at the top there.
Right. So, and the epidermis of a tree then is bark, sap, then you're at the point of.
It's bark, sapwood, which is still got a lot of moisture going up and down it, then heartwood, which is the more durable
stuff. Hard stuff.
And that's the stuff you work with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
Russ, that's an insult you've often called me, a gnarly lump.
Yeah.
So I'm you can call him Bear in future.
I call you a burry lump. Yes. A burry bear.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
You could say brown.
Yellow.
Brown.
Like, oh, yellow. Brown. Okay. Ebony. Yes.
I'd have to go with red.
Oh. And why red?
I like it.
Okay.
I mean, it's very tricky with colours, isn't it?
You're talking colour of clothes or colour of houses or colour of the sky or what? Yeah. They're all different.
Yeah. What's your favourite colour?
Go on, Russ.
Well, I'm blue or orange. I kind of like more vibrant blues and oranges, like fluoro sort of side of it.
I love orange because I was told when I was a teenager that orange was a really invigorating colour and it would make you feel positive. So I used to wear it a lot. And I actually find it to be a true thing. It's almost like you can change your mental state through what colour you wear or surround yourself with.
Yeah.
And I've become really attracted to orange in ceramics as well. I love it when it's glazed on ceramic. I love the kind of the richness of orange. I find it quite invigorating.
Yeah, there was a time when I was quite depressed. Mm. And I bleached my hair at the front and dyed it red, and it cheered me up no end. I mean, it really did make quite a difference. Yeah. It was just the front bit.
You know, behind you, you're surrounded by books. So there is literature or reading something that inspires you both. I heard that you've obviously made artist books yourselves, but is that something that is a big sort of source of inspiration for you?
Well, I love to read. I mean, those books behind us are all work related. They're all art books.
Oh, really? This
is the which office. Is a great, you know.
This is our office. This is
a great way to look at people's work that you can't afford and have it around and enjoy it. But I mean, I love to read a novel. That would be my favourite pastime.
That's how you switch off.
What sort of novels have you been reading recently?
I just finished reading Colm Toybeans. What's it called? The Magician.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which I thought was really interesting about sort of life of German expat. As it was about Thomas Mann, the author, German expatriate, German evacuee from the Nazis. Really like that because I was just completely absorbed in this world that is so far removed from where I live and how I live. And I'm just reading another book whose name I've forgotten, but it's about young Indian men trying to make a life in England, which is really, really interesting. Mm. So yeah, contemporary literary novels is what I love.
Yeah, yeah.
Provides an escape from your actual work, I guess, as well.
Yeah,
it's quite a physical experience. What you guys do?
It is paper. Well, it's kind of wood.
It feeds into a different thing. Doesn't it?
It's still part of like the tree family. So you're not really escaping.
But what it's true. I prefer to read a book than I would read on a screen. So
yeah. I like that. Well, it's an object, isn't it? That you like. We like objects.
Yeah.
What is the best advice? What's the best advice that you've ever received when it comes to your practice?
Floris van der Brocke, who is professor at furniture at the Royal College, told me I ought to work harder. I didn't take that advice.
Work quite hard. Best advice.
Oh, yeah. The guy at Southern Arts, when they commissioned a shelter. So we were commissioned to make a shelter in Chilton Sculpture Trail a long time ago. And Southern Arts were funding it, and their arts officer, whose name I can't recall, sadly.
David.
Anyway he said, we want you to push yourselves further, do something bigger and grander.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, that's not a failure. Playing it safe, he said, would be a failure, and we don't want that, so try. That was good.
Yeah.
That was really good advice. And it was a lovely, really nice thing.
And so it worked. Was right. It worked. And have you carried that forwards then?
No.
No. So you like to play it safe. So play it safe isn't a failure for you, but in that example, it could have been.
No.
Well, that stretched us. And then that became, we can do things this scale.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I know, it's so funny that thinking big and having the permission.
So that was before all the big foot bridges, wasn't it?
Was it? Yes, it was. Yeah. It was called
the
big.
So it gave us the confidence to.
And the permission to do that.
And the permission to do big.
Yeah. And not to worry about it.
And not to worry about it, yeah.
Although you do.
Yeah. Nature of the beast. Yes.
I've loved this. Yeah.
This has been amazing. Brilliant. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for coming on Talk Art, Jim Partridge and Liz Walmsley.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for making it such a nice thing.
No worries.
And for everyone listening, we'll be posting images on our Instagram at TalkArt. And you can also visit the Oxford Ceramics Gallery until the 22nd of December. So get there before Christmas. And you can see the wonderful new installation with the table called On the Table that has lots of different artists all interacting with Liz and Jim's table.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back very soon. You guys aren't on Instagram, are you?
Oh, you are?
No. Well, yes. No.
Oh, you're privately on it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm on it. I haven't posted anything this year.
Okay.
We're not big on Instagram.
We'll put your hashtag so that people can discover images of your work there, and we'll also be sharing lots of images.
And all the
Thank
galleries.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been so lovely to spend time with you.
Great.
And see you very soon.
Yeah. Great. Lovely. Thanks a lot.
We'll be back very soon. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.